بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم. My name is Harun Spivak, from the American Society of Islamic Philosophy and Theology. And I welcome everyone to our first in a series. Right now, our series is tentatively called Mature Philosophical Theology, an Overview of the Mawaqif of Al-Iji. And alhamdulillah, we have Sheikh Hamza Karamali with us today to lead us in our first lecture, which is called Aristotle, Revelation, and Kalam. Before we begin, and as more attendees filter in, what I'll do is I'll just briefly introduce a few things to you. I'd like to introduce the American Society of Islamic Philosophy and Theology, mention a few things about our conferences, publications, working groups, and symposia such as this one. And then a brief introduction to why the Mawaqif, why this particular series. So the American Society of Islamic Philosophy and Theology is funded by a generous grant from the Templeton Foundation and housed at Brandeis University and partnering with the Bukhari Institute and with Harvard's Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations and also Basira. And our goal as a society is, you know, we have a number of different goals. Among them are basically to produce suhba, to produce a sense of community amongst scholars, academics, and students of sacred knowledge, anyone interested in Islamic philosophy and theology, to bring us all together out of our sort of lonely silos and to communicate and collaborate and work together. So it's a society where members can participate in conferences, working groups, and we also have publication channels. So I'll briefly just introduce a few of those. We have an annual conference, which we've done twice now at Harvard University. The first one was actually in 2019, which was a general conference. And then the first one as part of this Templeton-funded series was on epistemology back in the fall of 2020. Our next one is on the instrumental sciences. And of course, we're still interested in epistemology throughout, but we're thinking about really focusing in this particular conference on the study of mantiq, the study of logic, the study of munadhara, dialectic and debate, ilm al-wada, philosophy of language, and so on. Anything that's related to the instrumental sciences, we're interested in hearing your papers and presentations. So visit our website, acipt.org, for information about our conferences and to submit a paper if you're interested. As far as publications go, we have partnered with a print journal called the Journal of Islamic Philosophy, which has been around for, I think, about 15 years or so now, and or more. And here we publish academic articles on a broad selection of topics on Islamic philosophy and theology, with a particular focus on the discipline of philosophy, as well as intellectual history. In addition to the academic journal, we also have ACIPT's budding online journal, which we actually will probably merge in some way with JIP. But in any case, the idea here is to have an opportunity for applied theology and philosophy. JIP is more of an academic journal that meets the specific standards of the academy. I'm smiling at the sip of tea comment in the chat. We're very excited about that as well. Thank you. The Journal of Islamic Philosophy is our purely academic channel, purely in the sense that it meets the requirements of academia, of the disciplines of academia. And then we have an applied journal, which is where we're interested in people actually doing Islamic theology and philosophy, addressing particular issues through the lens or lenses of Islamic philosophy. So we invite your submissions to both of these channels, and you can find that under publications. A third channel publication is shorter essays and projects that might not be full-length books or full-length articles, short studies, even just a page or two on a very detailed topic. One example of that kind of work that we've ended up doing is this comparative logic glossary, where we've put together a glossary of terms in Arabic and then found their English translations in a number of different translators, including Sheikh Hamza Karamali's translation of a text that I'm sure he'll talk about going forward, and a number of other scholars and translators' work. So it's a work in progress, but we're also working to collaborate and to coordinate our terminology such that we can understand the Arabic Islamic logical texts, logic texts, and translate them into the various different English language traditions as well. Finally, we have working groups that I want to call your attention to. They began originally as an effort to bring people together to collectively study texts asynchronously using this hypothesis software such that we can comment on texts. You can select parts of the text and comment on them and then have conversations in the margins. And we've expanded to Telegram chats, to weekly or monthly meetings, and collaboration, you know, text collaborations. And one of the things that grew out of our working groups, which is, you know, bringing people together who are interested in the study of Islamic theology and philosophy to engage more frequently than the once a year at a conference or once every 5 years at a conference. Again, sometimes weekly, sometimes monthly. One of the things that have grown out of this has been this need for symposia or short courses or deep studies of topics. And so among we've done a few now, but this among the first is this particular one that you've joined today. So just want to invite everybody to if you're interested in publishing with us, we have channels for articles, channels for essays, and also channels for books, which I'll you know mention another time. But why we're here today was the need to give a broad overview of an important kalam or Islamic philosophical theology text. We started with Teftazani's, with the epistemology portion of Teftazani's commentary on An-Nasafi. And the next step in our working group curriculum is to move on to the Mawaqif, which is a mature and an important snapshot of the state of Islamic theology at a particular point in history. And the deep study of this text, along with its commentaries and super commentaries, gives one a much deeper appreciation of the possibilities for the study of kalam, the study of Islamic theology, and its application. One of the things, just to give one last point about the background on this, was that from my experience as a person who studied some kalam 15 years ago and somebody said, hey, you know your stuff, I realized pretty quickly that I didn't know my stuff and that there was quite a lot more to learn. And when you crack open the Mawaqif of Al-Iji, one realizes that there's an ocean of knowledge that is often ignored in a lot of contemporary curricula. And so our goal is to produce a critical mass of well-trained scholars and budding scholars who can do applied Islamic theology. And so this is one of the first steps in that process. And with that, I will close this introduction and welcome and thank Sheikh Hamza and pass the mic over to you.
Thank you for the introduction, Dr. Haroon. InshaAllah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, wa sallallahu wa sallam ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. So I called this first seminar Aristotle, Revelation, and Kalam. Why I gave it this name is the subject of this presentation today. And it's actually motivated by a section from the Sharh al-Aqa'id of Sa'aduddin al-Taftazani. I'm going to be talking about him shortly, but I'll open with this, with reading this passage from the beginning of his work. So al-Taftazani, he has a book called Sharh al-Aqa'id al-Nasafiyya, which is arguably the most influential book of kalam ever written, studied in madrasas all over the Muslim world. To this day, it's part of the Darul Uloom curriculum in the Deoband. It's taught at Azhar. It was taught in the Ottoman madrasas, a very important book. And you can judge its importance by the number of commentaries and commentaries and commentaries and commentaries and commentaries and commentaries and even commentaries and commentaries and commentaries and commentaries, and the book is itself a commentary. So it's a very important book. And in the beginning, he gives an overview of a historical overview of the science of kalam. And he has a very important passage. And in that passage, he says the following. He says, he describes old early kalam and late kalam. Early kalam, he describes, was an encounter with the Mu'tazila. So the science of Islamic theology, it grew out of conversations. And so early kalam was people like Al-Baqillani, Al-Ash'ari, Al-Maturidi, Al-Juwayni, these scholars, they tackled theological issues in conversation with the Mu'tazila. And so this is early kalam. He says, then you have late kalam. And he writes, ثُمَّ انْتَقَلَتْ الْفَلْسَفَةَ إِلَى الْعَرَبِيَةِ. He says, then falsafa was translated or moved to the Arabic language. It was translated into Arabic. Falsafa here, I'm going to talk about what exactly is meant by falsafa. It's not the same as the word philosophy in the English language. It has a very particular meaning in an Islamic context. So it's he says this falsafa, it was translated into Arabic. He says, وَخَاضَ فِيهَا الْإِسْلَامِيُونَ. Al-Islamiyun, this is a term used in Kalam. It refers to anybody who ascribes themselves to Islam. So someone who Islamic orthodoxy might even judge to be not Muslim, but they call themselves Muslim, and then they engage in falsafa or in theological inquiry as people who identify as Muslims. These are called al-Islamiyun. So anybody who calls himself a Muslim identifies as a Muslim. So he says that these scholars, people who are identified as Muslims, خَاضُوا فِيهِ, they did falsafa, they engaged in falsafa. He says, حَاوَلُوا الرَّدَّ عَلَى الْفَلَاسِفَ فِيمَا خَالَفُوا فِيهِ الشَّرِيعَ. So when that happened, then the scholars of Kalam, they tried to respond to the falasifa on the issues in which they went against the Sharia. Sharia often is translated as law, sacred law. But in this context, that's not what it means. Shara has another meaning in books of Kalam. It refers to revelation. It refers to revealed knowledge. So he says that the falasifa, so I'll give you a sneak preview. Falsafa is the human activity of seeking to discover things using the mind alone, unaided by revelation. So and that begins in the Western intellectual tradition with Aristotle. So, and hence that's the name of the, it's the title of this presentation. So he says that the falasifa who, the Islamiyun who did falsafa, they, and then the mutakallimun after that, they responded to, they corrected, they had an intellectual response to the falsafa when it went against the conclusions of revealed knowledge. So this is interestingly worded because it says that they responded to the conclusions of the falasifa that went against revelation. What about the other branches of falsafa that didn't go against revelation? What did they do with that? They didn't respond to it. They integrated it. They swallowed it. It became Islamic. So, and that's the story of this book, Al-Mawaqif, that you see here, on which these series of seminars are based on. So the idea here is that Al-Mawaqif represents the mature Kalam tradition, mature philosophical theology. And this integrates Aristotle with the revelation given to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And we need to understand this in order to be able to use the book. So I'm taking as a point of departure this section from the Sharh al-Aqaid of At-Taftazani. So he says that فَخَلَطُوا بِالْكَلَامِ كَثِيرًا مِنَ الْفَلْسَفَةِ. So what did they do? They mixed falsafa with kalam. They corrected on particular issues and then they mixed it all together. لِيَتَحَقَّقُوا مَقَاصِدَهَا فَيَتَمَكَّنُوا مِنْ إِبْطَالِهَا. So why? Because they wanted to really master it. Because you cannot respond to something until you understand it. So they mastered it thoroughly. They became better at it than the philosopher themselves, and then they corrected it, and the rest of it they swallowed. فَيَتَمَكَّنُوا مِنْ إِبْطَالِهَا وَهَلُمَّ جَرَّ and so on, إِلَىٰ أَنْ أَدْرَجُوا فِيهِ مُعْظَمُ الطَّبِيعِيَاتِ until they put into the science of kalam most of a branch of falsafa called al-tabi'iyat, natural philosophy. I'm going to talk about that, insha'Allah. Wal-ilahiyat, this is metaphysics. I'm going to talk about that, insha'Allah. Wa-khadu fil-riyadiyat, and they digressed into mathematics, particular kind of mathematics, different than the math that we do today. Hatta kada la yatamayyaz عن الفلسفة لولا اشتماله على السمعيات until what happened was that the science of kalam became indistinguishable from falsafa were it not for the section on سمعيات which is سمعيات are the prophecy and matters of the afterlife. He says وهذا هو كلام المتأخرين and this is the kalam of the late scholars, late kalam, and the book Al-Mawaqif represents that kalam. So Al-Mawaqif, you can think of At-Taftazani as talking about Al-Mawaqif. The author of Al-Mawaqif, Adud-Din Al-Iji, was the teacher of Taftazani. Taftazani graduated at his hands. So this is why the title of this presentation is Aristotle, Revelation, and Kalam. So just a quick intellectual history. So Aristotle is the student of Plato, who was the student of Socrates. And somebody I worked with a while ago, he commented that Christian philosopher, he commented that Aristotle, before the modern university, Aristotle was the university. Now, when we think of human knowledge, the repository of human knowledge, you go to a university and you look at all of the departments in that university. You'll have a physics department, biology department, department of management, department of computer science, department of engineering, medicine. So this is the repository of human knowledge, repository of falsafa. So the modern university, it does falsafa because falsafa is arriving at conclusions using the mind alone, unaided by revelation. So when we study biology, we use the mind alone. We don't use revelation. When we do economics, we use the mind alone, although we should use revelation when we do that. And I'll talk a little bit about that. So that's why I've called this slide the University of Aristotle. And he actually made a school called the Lyceum in a pagan temple dedicated to Apollo. And it lasted for many, many centuries, and they studied his works. So Aristotle is regarded as the most influential philosopher of all time. And his works, they exercised a formative influence on philosophy for over 2,000 years. I've put the word philosopher, I've highlighted the word philosopher, because I want us to think about what it was that Aristotle was doing versus what it is that a mutakallim does, what it is that a scholar of kalam does. Aristotle was the seminal and defining philosopher of the Western intellectual history, of Western intellectual history. So again, I've highlighted this. What do we mean by Western intellectual history? And where does Islam figure in to all of that? And kalam, I'm going to, that's going to be the theme here, is the thing that brings everything together. So there's two paths from Aristotle. So you have Aristotle, 335 BC. Then you had a figure called Plotinus, not sure how to pronounce him. But Neoplatonism comes from him. And so in this period, from Aristotle to Al-Farabi, who was a part of the translation movement or of Greek philosophy into Arabic. There were debates over whether Aristotle was correct or whether Plato was correct, and where did they disagree. This was a defining feature of philosophical debates at that time. Plotinus is important, and Al-Farabi inherited Aristotle through Plotinus or Plotinus. And then you have Ibn Sina. Ibn Sina is, he defines later Kalam. And then from Ibn Sina, there are two paths. There's one path that is well known, and this is the path of the Western narrative. So from Ibn Sina, you have, or after him, you have Ibn Rushd, a thoroughgoing Aristotelian. And both Ibn Sina and Ibn Rushd, in Latin translation, were read by Thomas Aquinas, and Aristotelianism entered Christianity, entered the Western intellectual tradition. And then you have the European Enlightenment that reacts to Aristotle through Thomas Aquinas. Then on the other side, you have a less known narrative. And so this narrative is often, it used to be popular, it's now being corrected. But a decade ago, maybe 2 decades ago, the value of Islamic philosophy was how it facilitated modernity. And the other side, which is now being increasingly studied, was neglected in the academy. The other side is the path of Kalam, because through Ibn Sina, there's another path that Aristotle took, and that went through the leading mutakallimun, first Imam al-Ghazali, who wrote Maqasid al-Falasifa, in which he analyzed, summarized the work of Ibn Sina. He understood it. And then he wrote his famous Tahafut, The Incoherence of the Philosophers. He was followed by Fakhruddin al-Razi, who was a faylusuf par excellence. He's considered one of the pillars of philosophy, pillars of falsafa, by the late Muslim philosopher, along with Ibn Sina, along with Aristotle. After Fakhruddin al-Razi, you have three figures. You have Adud-ud-Din al-Iji, who's the author of the Mawaqif that we're studying. You have his student, Taftazani, and Sharif al-Jurjani was a student of Taftazani, or he learned from him a little bit. And these three figures, Adud-ud-Din al-Iji, Sa'ud-ud-Din al-Taftazani, and Sayyid al-Sharif al-Jurjani, they represent the mature Kalam tradition. And there's disagreements between Taftazani and Jurjani. These are some of the defining disagreements in the late Kalam tradition. I find it interesting that if you look at all of these great figures, I like their titles, right? Hujjat al-Islam, the proof of Islam. Fakhruddin, the pride of religion. Adud al-Din, the support of religion. Sa'ad al-Din, the joy of religion. And these titles were given and to them, and they persisted. And this shows the importance of the work that they did in studying falsafa and integrating it into an Islamic revelatory perspective. So I have a work, it's available online, it's called The Madrasa Curriculum in Context. And a lot of what I'm saying here, you'll find it there. I describe the revelatory sciences and the philosophical sciences and Kalam. And so this is an elaboration of some of the ideas that are presented there. In the madrasa, in the Muslim institution of learning, the sciences that the scholars studied were divided into ulum shar'iyya. Again, shar'iyya here doesn't mean legal. It means derived from revelation. And you had ulum falsafiyya, philosophical sciences. So the ulum shar'iyya, these relied on revelation. So the science of tafsir is a ilm shar'i. The science of hadith is a ilm shar'i. It's, you study revelation itself. The science of sacred law, fiqh, is ilm shar'i. The science of usul al-fiqh, legal theory, is ilm shar'i. So you had the revelatory sciences. And these, they relied on revelation to come to their conclusions. Then you had the philosophical sciences. And the philosophical sciences, they rely on the mind alone. So when you do math, when you work out a math problem, You don't say that the Quran says this, therefore 2 + 2 = 4. No, you solve this problem using the mind alone. So the philosophical sciences, they use the mind alone. But when you look at the revelatory sciences, they rely on revelation, but there's something special about the Muslim tradition of learning, and that is that revelation obligates us to use our minds to discern that it's true. So in the science of Kalam, we learn that the first obligation of every human being, let alone a Muslim, is to reflect, is nazar, is to reflect on the universe, come to the conclusion that God exists, reflect on the miracles and the character of the prophets, come to the conclusion that they're genuine, and then use that to discover the purpose of their lives by listening to revelation and learning about the afterlife and what they're responsible to do in this life. So all of this is grounded in rational reasoning. So since revelation obligates us to use our minds to discern that it's true, the philosophical sciences, if the mind is used properly, they fit neatly into the revelatory sciences. And that's what happened. And so there was an integration that took place. And the story of going from Ibn Sina to Ghazali to Razi to Iji to Taftazani to Jurjani is the story of that integration. And what we're going to look at today is we're going to look at the mature result of that integration, which was in the works of Adluddin al-Iji. Adluddin al-Iji was a judge. He was a Shafi'i jurist. He was called Qadi Qudat al-Sharq. He was born just outside Shiraz. He was a scholar of Usul al-Fiqh. He has a very important book. I'll tell you about that shortly. He was a theologian. He was a philosopher. He was a polymath. He wrote in everything. He was a Shafi'i Ash'ari. Iran at that time was a stronghold of Shafi'i Ash'ariism. And he's known for his very precise wording. He used few words, which makes him difficult to understand to somebody who's not an expert in what he's talking about. That's why he needs commentaries. He needs super commentaries. And he graduated great and accomplished students. The greatest of them was Sa'aduddin al-Taftazani. Al-Iji has many works, but three of them stand out. So on the left is Al-Mawaqif fi Ilm al-Kalam, which along with Al-Maqasid of al-Taftazani are the authoritative works of the late Kalam tradition. They're used by Ash'aris and they're used by Maturidis. They're used by Sunnis, they're even used by Shi'is. So they represent the mature tradition of philosophical theology in Islam. And Adluddin al-Iji in al-Mawaqif, he did a really wonderful job, like 500 pages of terse and pithy prose that summarize the entire, every single discussion in the science of Kalam over the last 1,000 plus years. So it's a great, and by somebody who is a genius. He also has another work in the science of Usul, which you see in the middle here. He has a commentary on Mukhtasar al-Muntaha, which is a work in Usul al-Fiqh by a Maliki scholar. And so Al-Iji has a commentary on it. He's a Shafi'i. And Taftazani has a Hashiya on it. And the Hanafis claim Taftazani, although the Shafi'is will fight them over him. So it's a really important work in the science of Usul al-Fiqh, and it's very closely related to Kalam. And it can be used by all of the four schools. So that's a very important work. And on the right here, you have his commentary on his work on Ilm al-Wada. So Adluddin al-Iji is the founder of Ilm al-Wada. Ilm al-Wada, which Dr. Haroon talked about briefly in the beginning, he mentioned it, is the science of how words are associated with meanings. And it's a very fascinating science. It's there implicitly in the science of Balagha. It's there scattered in the science of Sarf, in the science of Usul. So Adluddin al-Iji took everything, he organized it, and it became a science. So it's an important science. So that's al-iji. So if we come back to our point of departure, which was Sharh al-Aqaid of At-Taftazani, in this section, he talked about So I'll take inshallah questions at the end. So if you have kind of comments as I'm talking, I'm not looking at them. And afterwards, if I go back, I'll be lost because I don't know what you're reacting to. So if you have a question, please put it in the Q&A and with a context so that I can address it at the end, inshallah. So the so here you have Sharh al-Aqaid, and then in the margins you have a hashiya. It's the hashiya of Kastali. It's a nice hashiya. It's clear, easy to read. And he comments on falsafa. So he says that lamma intaqalat al-falsafa ila al-arabiyya, when falsafa was translated into Arabic. So he defines falsafa in the margins. And he says al-falsafa, he says it's hikmah. So the falasifa are called al-hukama. That's another name for them. And he says wa'arrafuha bi'annahu ilmun باحثٌ فيه عن أحوال الأعيان الموجودات على ما هي عليه في نفس الأمر بقدر الطاقة البشرية. So we're going to look at this definition. So falsafa, this was Aristotelianism inherited by the Mutakallimun through the lens of Ibn Sina. It is studying, it's البحث عن الموجودات. So falsafa studies things that exist. Everything that exists. The goal of falsafa is to learn about everything that exists. Ala ma hiya alayhi, as the mawjudat, as they really are. So it seeks to be accurate. Fi nafs al-amr, there's fi nafs al-amr is in things as they are, important philosophical concept. بقدر الطاقة البشرية, and that's what I want to focus on, because بقدر الطاقة البشرية, in it, It tells us that the falasifa, what they are doing is they're using the human mind. They're using the human mind alone to study everything that exists as it really is. So this is falsafa. This is the project of falsafa. So falsafa was divided into two categories. This is a historical artifact of that time. It was divided into six sciences. Three of them are called practical sciences, ulum amaliya. Three of them are called theoretical sciences, ulum nazariya. The practical sciences, the difference between these two, they said, is that both of them study things that exist. But if the things that exist, they come about as a result of a choice that's made by a human, by an agent, i.e. human actions, then we call them practical sciences. So the practical sciences are three: ilm al-akhlaq, ethics, tadbir al-manzil. This is the relations between husband and wife and children. And in those days, there were slaves, so slave and master. And as-siyasa al-madaniya, this is politics. The mutakallimun aren't concerned about this branch of philosophy. They're concerned more about the other three branches of philosophy. And in the marginal gloss that I showed you, we'll go back to it. He's going to say that falsafa is divided into three parts, and he's going to mention these three parts. And these three parts are al-ilm al-ilahi, ilm al-riyadiyat, and al-ilm al-tabi'i. So al-ilm al-ilahi, it's called the divine knowledge, and you can see that kalam is going to come from here. So the idea behind this here is that the physical world isn't everything that exists. Beyond the physical world, there's something non-physical. There's something immaterial. So that's what the philosopher, they called it immaterial. They had this distinction between material and immaterial. We'll see the mutakallimin, they changed it a little bit. So here, in the Hashia, he talks about these three sciences. He talks about, he says that... the science of falsafa has three branches. He says, لِأَنَّ الْمَوْجُودِ إن كان مستغنيا عن المادة في الوجود الخارجي والذهني فالعلم فالباحث عن أحواله يسمى الإلهي. So العلم الإلهي, the goal of العلم الإلهي is to prove that the universe depends on another being, God, in other words. So العلم الإلهي, it studies a being, a موجود, which he says here is مستغني عن المادة. It doesn't need matter. It's immaterial. Immaterial. So he says that the branch of falsafa that studies the immaterial being is called العلم الإلهي. He says that it doesn't require matter, neither it's immaterial. And then the second one he says that well so this one is called al-ilm al-ilahi. It's also called al-falsafat al-ula, first philosophy. In English we use those names too. It's also called metaphysics. It's also called, they say, before physics. And there's a reason why they say after and before. Because it's after physics, because you look at the physics as natural philosophy, you study natural philosophy from the natural world, you infer the existence of this immaterial being. So it's after physics in that sense. That's what this Muslims will say. So according to them, it's not because he an ordering of the book in Aristotle's Organon. And they'll say that it's before physics, because in order for the natural world to come into existence, this being needs to exist. He says, so this is the first branch of falsafa, al-ilm al-ilahi. He says that if it, on the other hand, he says that if it needs matter to exist, it's called al-ilm al-tabi'i. Ilm al-tabi'i is from tabi'a, nature, natural philosophy. This is the study of the universe. It's roughly speaking what science is today, the study of the physical universe. And so al-ilm al-tabi'i, study of the physical universe. So Aristotle believed in celestial spheres. And then here you have, what is the physical universe composed of? The mutakallimun, they have this theory of atoms and accidents or their properties. And the falasifa have this theory of hylomorphism. And so all of those discussions, they come in this science called al-ilm al-tabi'i. And you have a third one, which is called mathematics, which they say is material. It applies to material things, but it's not material, because it's in the mind. So these are the three branches of falsafa. And I want you to note that this distinction between material and immaterial is a remnant of Aristotelianism. So you can actually, you can observe as you go through it, and I'll show you through the other chapters, that what did the mutakallimun do? The mutakallimun, they received falsafa, they critiqued it, they corrected it, and then they did it, and then they integrated it with revelation. So there are purely falsafa discussions that have no bearing on religious belief. Right? So when they talk about the physical constitution of the universe, and they talk about the celestial spheres, and they talk about even atoms, and they talk about these kinds of things, these are philosophical discussions that revelation is silent on. So it spilled over. So they, and Taftazani explained that they needed to engage falsafa because it was some of its rational conclusions went against revelation. And so they engaged it on those points, and then they spilled over. And then the spillover relates to revelation in different ways. Some of the spillover is distantly related. Some of it is neutral. You don't have to hold that position. They're just doing falsafa. And that's important, because when we look at this late kalam tradition, it's not Quran and Sunnah. But But Quran and Sunnah is an important part of it. But it's not Quran and Sunnah. It's falsafa that was swallowed by the Muslim scholars. And so when you look at this distinction between material and immaterial, this is a remnant. So this is, I had this picture of Hagia Sophia. I visited it just last week and alhamdulillah, I enjoyed it very much. And so when you go there, it's a mosque. But when you go into the mosque, you have remnants of what the mosque used to be. It used to be a church. So similarly, when you look at Kalam, this late Kalam tradition, you see clearly Islamic elements, but you will see the remnants of where it came from. And one of those remnants is this distinction between material and immaterial, which is a defining point of Aristotelian philosophy, of Avicenna, of others. So you have change in the material world, and the immaterial world is unchanging. And then there's an emanation. There's a series of emanation. This is Neoplatonism. Series of emanations. You go, the immaterial goes from the one to being more and more multiple. And as it becomes more and more multiple, it becomes more material. This is falsafa. And this is how they divided the things that exist. The mutakallimun didn't divide it that way. They divided things that exist as being contingent or necessary, mumkin or wajib, or they divided them as being hadith, beginning to exist, or not beginning to exist. But and so you'll see them doing this, but in the background you'll see these remnants of the falsafa tradition. So al-ilmul ilahi, of these three branches, al-ilmul ilahi, the metaphysics, and you have mathematics and natural philosophy, the most important of these three sciences for kalam is al-ilmul ilahi. Al-ilmul ilahi became kalam. So what's al-ilmul ilahi? Al-ilmul ilahi is the study, al-bahthu anil mawjood, bima huwa mawjood. So you study things that exist from what perspective? From the perspective of there being things that exist. So when you study science, when you study natural philosophy, you study things from the perspective of their change, of their changing, going from one thing into another thing. What are the causes of the changes in physical things? So approximately what natural philosophy does, it studies change in the physical world. And what causes that change? So it studies things that exist, one group of things that exist, but from this perspective of their changing and what causes that change, science is, it's similar in many respects. Al-ilmul ilahi, it studies things that exist from the perspective of there being things that exist. Another way to look at this is that this studies existence. So scholars have called this ontology. It's the study of being. So what the ilmul ilahi looks at the universe, and it says that the universe is one kind of existent thing. I'm going to examine this kind of existent thing, and I'm going to infer from this kind of existent thing another kind of existent thing. So this is, and that's going to be God. And this is al-ilmul ilahi. It's the idea that the existence of this universe depends on the existence of another being. So for the philosopher, you went from the material world to the immaterial being, or through a series of emanations to the one immaterial being. For the mutakallimun, you went from either mumkin or hadith. They're interrelated, because everything that's contingent begins to exist, and everything that begins to exist is contingent. And there's a discussion on which one is primary. We'll get to that discussion as we walk through the mawaqif in greater detail. But for them, we look at this universe and we analyze it in terms of its existence. What kind of existence is it? It's something that is contingent. It's dependent. It needs something to make it exist. It began to exist. And so from this, I infer a being that exists, that has another kind of existence, a necessary existence, a beginningless existence. So this is al-bahthu anil mawjoodi bima huwa mawjood, from the perspective of its being something that exists. So this became kalam. And we'll see that one of the definitions of kalam is basically this, with one tweak that I'm getting to, and that'll be, I'll conclude the presentation with that. So if we come back to our point of departure, which is this section from the Sharh al-Aqa'id of At-Taftazani, and he talks about this encounter with falsafa, and he's describing how the mature kalam tradition integrated falsafa with revelation. So what does this mature kalam tradition look like? So the Al-Iji's book is called Al-Mawaqif. Mawaqif, it means stopping points. So you have the first stopping point, the second stopping point, the third stopping point, chapters, in other words, sections. So it's consists of six sections, six mawaqif. So if you were to look at the entire book of Al-Iji, which represents this late kalam tradition, which swallowed falsafa and became this al-ilm al-ilahi, this is what it looks like. So you have al-mawqif al-awwal, which is al-muqaddimat, and you have al-mawqif al-thani, which is al-umur al-amma, then you have al-a'rad, al-jawahir, al-ilahiyat, and al-sam'iyat. And I'll walk you through these one by one and tell you why you have these six sections in Al-Iji's Al-Mawaqif. So the first one is called Al-Muqaddimat. So Al-Muqaddimat are sometimes we translate as introductions, but that's actually not what it means. Muqaddimat here is not, it's a mistake to translate it as an introduction or introductory investigation. The Muqaddimah here, it's Muqaddimatul Ilm, which you study in the science of Islamic logic. So there's a theory of sciences and classification of sciences that, again, they inherited from Ibn Sina, but they refined it, made it much better. And the idea here is that every science, it's composed of propositional statements. Propositional statements. A propositional statement is A is B. You have a subject, you have a predicate. So they defined sciences by defining the kind of propositional statement that characterizes that science. So for example, in the science of fiqh, you would say that the prayer is obligatory. To pray is obligatory. As-salatu wajiba. So if you look at this, the science of fiqh, you'll see that the subject is always a human action. You have prayer is a human action. Zakat is a human action. Marriage is a human action, it's a contract. It's always a human action. So you have a human action, that's always the subject, and you study the human action from a particular perspective, and then there's a well-defined predicate that you give. One of the five ahkam shari'iyya, right? Obligatory, recommended, permissible, offensive, unlawful, and you could add some more as well. And so once you do this, you now define the problems, the questions, the propositional statements that define this science. So the sciences in the madrasa tradition are defined by propositional statements. So you study those propositional statements, you prove them true. It's a very different way of organizing books than a chapter with exercises. And so when you have this propositional statement, this propositional statement assumes certain certain things. So there's certain kinds of knowledge that there's certain conclusions that the proper that this science is going to inherit from another science. So the science of fiqh inherits conclusions from the science of usul al-fiqh. And the science of usul al-fiqh inherits conclusions from the science of kalam. So you can actually stack all of the sciences together. And kalam is at the bottom, below it is logic. And that's why it's called usul al-deen. And it's a very fascinating subject because it actually shows you the importance of kalam. And it shows you how everything, all of the Islamic sciences, tafsir, hadith, everything, they all stack together on top of each other in a series of logical syllogisms that go back to kalam, which goes back to logic, and you prove everything rationally true. So you do that for every science. You show how it stacks together, and he does it for kalam. That's what's meant by the muqaddimat. And so I'll walk you through this in greater detail in the first detailed look at Kitab al-Mawaqif. But this is what the table of contents looks like. So you have Mawaqif, and you have something called a Marsad. Marsad is a subsection. So the first Marsad, the first subsection, is it talks about the mawdu', the subject, the benefit of it. These are the 10 introductory investigations of every science. Then it talks about, it has an introduction to logic. It talks about logic, epistemology, propositional knowledge, conceptual knowledge. It talks about al-ulum al-daruriya on the left-hand side here. Daruri it's not necessary. It means non-inferential. It's not necessary knowledge, it's non-inferential knowledge. Knowledge arrived at without inference. So the mutakallimun were foundationalists. So they held that there were certain kinds of knowledge that you arrived at without inference. And you, through a series of inferences from those basic propositions, you come to the conclusions of kalam. And you prove that Islam is true. Talks about nazar, it talks about inference, and finally he talks about definition. The tariq is definition, because in order to infer, you have to define things correctly. They say a famous statement, al-hukmu ala shay'i far'un an tasawwurihi, before you can say something is something or isn't, you have to conceive of it properly. So these are the introductory, the prolegomenon to the science, scholarly prolegomenon to the science of kalam. So this is the first thing that he does, and he defines kalam, and this is, when we, inshallah, go through this, a lot of what I've said will be relevant, and you'll see this in the in what he says over here. So that's the first section in the book of Al-Mawaqif. Then the next four sections, they are preparing the ground to argue for the existence of God in light of knowledge of the universe through falsafa. So before modern science, we looked at the universe, we understood the universe through some kind of Aristotelianism, and falsafa is a kind of Aristotelianism. And so we understood the universe through this lens. So we understand the universe through this lens. If we understand the universe through this lens, how do we use the universe to show that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala exists? So the argument of the mutakallimun is the cosmological argument. There's no, the mutakallimun don't use the ontological argument. Ontological argument begs the question. It's a flawed argument. They don't use other kinds of arguments. They don't use the design argument. They don't use, and it's for a reason, because none of these, the ontological argument doesn't work. The other arguments, they don't prove the same thing. What do we want to prove? We want to prove the existence of a necessary being. So there's only one path to that conclusion. And that's the path that the mutakallimun take. So they use a cosmological argument. A cosmological argument is an argument that argues for the existence of God through the cosmos. Cosmos is the universe. So it's a cosmological argument for the existence of God. So how does this work? You have to look at the cosmos. You look at the universe. So chapters, Mawqif 3 and 4, Mokif 3 is about a'rad. A'rad are contingent properties or material properties, depending on whether you look at it from the lens of the philosopher before Islam or after. And the jawahir are contingent objects or material objects, same distinction. So the mutakallimun, they looked at the universe and they said the universe is completely constituted by jawahir and a'rad. So jawahir are physical objects, and these physical objects, they can be are all composed of atoms. So you have kalam atomism. So the mutakallimun, they looked at the universe. They said you have atoms. These atoms, they come together to perform composite objects, and these composite objects, they have properties. They have they can be moving, they can be still, they can have color, they can have all these. We'll look at some of these properties. So they can have these properties. And so this is how they viewed the universe. The standard kalam argument for the existence of God is to say that the properties are created, therefore the objects are also created, therefore the universe began to exist, therefore there's a qadim being and who didn't begin to exist. And they go from there. But there's also the contingency argument. It's also here. And in these two sections, they also engage the hylomorphism of the falasifa. The falasifa didn't believe that the universe was discrete and composed of atoms, indivisible atoms, but they held it was continuous. And you had this matter, and it took on various forms. So what they do in the goal in Al-Mawaqif in chapters 3 and 4 is to comprehensively survey the entire cosmos, and it's preparing the way to use that to argue for the existence of God. Now, today we don't look at the universe in this way, right? So now today we have space time, we have atoms, we have molecules, we have energy, we have so how should the this work be updated in a thoroughgoing way, in a way that's relevant to our times at a deep level? That's a problem of contemporary kalam. So this is why these two chapters are there. Then from these two chapters, you come to the fifth chapter, which is you use the universe to prove the existence of a necessary being. That's why the fifth chapter, the fifth mawqif of Al-Mawaqif is Al-Ilahiyat, where you prove the existence of a necessary immaterial being. Now, I think one of the most important sections in the Mawaqif is the second section. The second, arguably this is the most important and useful mawqif for a contemporary Islamic philosophical theology. And this section is called Al-Umur Al-Amma. Aam means it's common. So these are common topics. These topics are common to the contingent universe and the necessary being on whom that contingent universe depends. So in Al-Umur Al-Amma, they discuss the tools that we need in order to go from the universe to God. So in this section, so this is an overview of the table of contents. So you have al-marsad al-awwal fil wujudi wal-adam. So what does it mean for something to exist? What does it mean for it to not exist? What kinds of existence are there? Are these different shades of existence, or are they different categories? These are, so existence, so this is a very important discussion in the science of kalam, because al-ilm al-ilahi is the study of existent things from the perspective of existence. So existence is something that's common, at least at a high level, to contingent and necessary things. There's actually a discussion whether or not it's common. And so all of these are high level, at a high level. So in order to, more details, we need to delve deeper. But So one of the umur amma are al-wujud and adam. So wujud is common to contingent and necessary things. What about adam? A necessary thing can't not exist. So adam is a property of only contingent things. So it's actually not a common thing, but it's yani mulhaqun bihi. It's you say wujud and its counterpart. So this is the first discussion in al-umur al-amma. The second discussion is fil mahiya. Mahiya is a compound word. Ma, what, hiya, it, what it is. So literally a mahiya is what something is, essence. So you have something, it is something, you understand what it is, and then you say whether or not it exists. First you understand what it is, then you come to the conclusion whether or not it exists. This is why the ontological argument is problematic, right? So you can't like sneak in existence into the definition. That's the begging the question. So you have the mahiya. So what does it mean for something to be what it is? That's the second discussion here. The third discussion is on al-wujub wal-imkan wal-imtina. This is a really important discussion. So this is about necessity and contingency and impossibility. What are these things? What does it mean for something to be necessary? What does it mean for something to be contingent? How do you know that things are contingent? Is the contingency of things something that we arrive at by inference, or is it non-inferential? How do we know the universe is contingent? And what exactly does it mean? They discuss it here. Again, wujub is actually not am, because it only applies to the necessary being. Imkan is not am. But together, they're like things and their counterparts that apply to necessary and contingent things. Then you have al-wahda and kasra, singularity and multiplicity. So in falsafa, you had immaterial things are, there's a unity, and then they go to more and more multiplicity as you get more and more material. And the counterpart in Islam is that the necessary being is one and the contingent universe is multiple. So what does it mean for something to be one and multiple? And finally, the last of the umur amma is on illa and ma'lul. Cause and effect, roughly speaking, not quite, because causation means it excludes volitional agency, the fi'l of an agent, but here that would be included. So approximately cause and effect. And so these are common topics that these are the tools that we're going to use to infer from the universe the existence of a necessary being. So many of these discussions, most of these discussions are unchanging, they're timeless. So these are things that are extremely relevant to a contemporary Islamic theology. The next two, which is A'rad and Jawahir, which is Al-Ilm al-Tabi'i. So Kalam is al-ilm al-ilahi, but ilm al-tabi'i is there as well. And you saw that in Taftazani's opening discussion where he said that they brought falsafa in. Hatta adraju fihi al-ilm al-tabi'i. Al-ilm al-tabi'i, why do you need to bring it in? Because in order to prove the existence of God, you need to look at the natural world. So these discussions, the discussions in al-ilm al-tabi'i, these are... So let me describe. So in A'rad, which are properties, they talk about the maqulat. The maqulat are the predicables, or the 10 categories of Aristotle. So these 10 categories are, you look at all existent, all contingent things, when you talk about the contingent things in the universe, you use concepts. And those concepts can all be categorized into one of 10 categories. So in here, He'll talk about the meaning of time, the meaning of place, the meaning of what is a relation, what is a relational concept, what is an attribute, a property, a kayfiyya. Things here that are useful. There's things that are outdated as well. And in the next section, which is on Jawahir, he's going to talk about atoms, composite objects, celestial spheres, earthly elements, Aristotle's elements, human souls. This is very, falsafa, Aristotelian-ish. It looks very foreign to somebody who studied modern science. But this is the way that they looked at the universe there. And there's useful things here, but it's less useful than the Umur Amma. And it's less useful than the A'rad. So there's a lot to learn by looking at it. Finally, we have the section on Ilahiyat. And Ilahiyat, in the section Ilahiyat, it uses the concepts in Umur Amma to analyze the A'rad and Jawahir, the universe, to prove the existence of a necessary being. And what you will find in the section of Ilahiyat here is what you'll find in any standard book of traditional Islamic theology. The attributes of God necessarily exists, that he's one, he doesn't resemble his creation, he didn't begin to exist, doesn't need anything, he has knowledge, will, power, that you can see him in the afterlife, all of those. So now it starts to look familiar. So the first four chapters of Al-Mawaqif, they form the bulk of the book. But if you open up an introductory book in Aqidah, like the Jawhara al-Tawheed, or the Sanusiya, or in the Ash'ari tradition, or the Bidayah or Al-Qa'id al-Nasafiyah in the Maturidi tradition, you won't see these first four things in great detail. What you'll see is you'll see the Ilahiyat, and you'll see the Sam'iyat. So the Ilahiyat and Sam'iyat are the standard Aqidah. So it's the existence of God, prophecy, and the afterlife. So the courses that I teach at Basira are based on this science. I have a course, Why Islam is True, which is a contemporary presentation of everything that's in here, the essential elements in these two sections. So these two sections, then what they do is they inform everything else. They inform, so the reason why I mentioned the Why Islam is True course is because what you'll find as you read this book, Kitab al-Mawaqif, is that most of it is not practical for 90% of people, 95% of people. It's only a small group of people who are interested in philosophical discussions, and they form, they come together to sip tea at ASIP tea, and they talk about these things. So complex, but they're needed. These topics are needed. It's more interesting. But for the average Muslim, you don't need that. You don't need this to show that your religion is true. You just need the Ilahiyat and Sam'iyat and a lot less than what's here to give a simple practical presentation. But if we come back to the Mawaqif, which is basically a book of falsafa with a kalam twist, what's the kalam twist? The kalam twist is that it's the Ilahiyat and Sam'iyat that go and inform everything else. They inform everything else. So everything else is tuned, is designed to come to the conclusions that you need in the Ilahiyat and Sam'iyat. So in Sam'iyat, you talk about prophets, miracles, afterlife, iman, kufr, the various sects. So everything here it's fine-tuned to go there. But more than that, what So if you go back, we said that the al-ilm al-ilahi is the branch of falsafa that became kalam. So what's al-ilm al-ilahi? What's metaphysics? It is al-bahthu anil mawjood bima huwa mawjood. You study things that exist from the perspective of their existence. So you look at the universe, and what you're interested in is not that this element reacts with this element to have this chemical reaction. What you're interested in is that all of these elements and the products of the chemical reaction, all of them are things that exist, and they exist contingently. And in as much as they exist contingently, they need something that exists necessarily for them to be the way that they are. So this is, you are studying things that exist from the perspective of there being things that exist. But with kalam, so there's a definition of kalam, of late kalam, which is basically this with one addendum. They say, ala qanun al-Islam, according to the measure of Islam. And this is interesting, because what they say is that in kalam, you take the conclusions first. The conclusions come first. In falsafa, you use your mind and you start thinking and you go wherever it is that it takes you. And a book of falsafa will then look like the wanderings, the intellectual wanderings of somebody who's using his mind to come to whatever conclusions that his wanderings might take him. But kalam, that's not what you do. You start with the conclusions, which seems at first counterintuitive, because the whole point of the exercise of kalam is to prove those conclusions true. But you actually, what you do is you go to the Quran and Sunnah, you look at the conclusions that you're supposed to come to, you put them there, and then you work backwards and you work out the rational arguments. And you might think that it's cheating, but it's not cheating if the rational arguments actually take you to that conclusion. So if the cheat sheet is correct, then it's a guide. And that's what it is. So it just happens to be correct. So the Imam al-Ghazali, he likened revelation to shining light, and the mind to the eye. So when you look, when you're using your mind, it's like you're seeing with your eyes. When you shine a light in light, then you can see with your eyes more clearly. You're still looking with your eyes, but you can see more clearly, and you're more likely to come to the right conclusion, because the light illuminates the path to the correct conclusions. And that's what revelation does. And that's why it's called ala qanun al-Islam. So it's the ilahiyat and the sam'iyat, which as Taftazani said, that were it not for the sam'iyat, this would just be the same as any intellectual wandering. Because remember, a faylusuf doesn't want revelation. He wants to use the mind alone. But what the mutakallim is doing, he's saying, if you use the mind alone, it will take you to revelation, and then revelation will open up a door of knowledge that's grounded in reason. And so there's this unity that happens. There's this integration that happens, and that's what this Taftazani is saying here in his passage in Sharh al-Aqaid. And what he's describing al-mawaqif, and that's why I call this Aristotle revelation and kalam. So what I had. And so I guess the plan is to have a series of more detailed walkthroughs of each of the six mawaqif, maybe something more. I'll leave Harun to comment if he wants to comment on that. And inshallah, the next session, maybe in 2 weeks, there'll be an announcement, inshallah, that will be sent out. So if you guys have any questions, I can take them. So I'm just looking at the questions. I haven't looked at the comments. So if you have any questions, you can type them in there. what is so is a question. Assalamu alaikum, wa alaikum salam. Do you consider there to be two or more discrete traditions of late mature kalam, one more philosophically inclined and one more traditional kalam, particularly considering Ghazali's method in Qawaid and I'tiqad, much more syllogistic than dialectic kalam approach? I think according to late Mutakallimun, Ghazali is early. So Ghazali begins to he doesn't do all of this falsafa in his so he does more of a tahafut, but I don't think he actually does an integration. Is there a critical or recommended edition of Mawaqif and Sharh al-Mawaqif? I only know the old one, which is what you will see. There's a PDF that's available online. And then you have Al-Mawaqif, you have the Sharh al-Mawaqif by Sayyid al-Sharif al-Jurjani, and then two Hawashi, one by Siyal Koti, Indian subcontinent, Punjabi, Siyal Kot, and another one by Chalabi and someone else. It's like, I think it's a standard one. There's two editions of this. They're both old editions. I think I have the Istanbul edition. They're both good. The old editions are all good. They're not easy to read. I don't know of a modern print. If somebody else does, inshallah, they can share. What is the name of Al-Iji's work on Ilm al-Wada? It's called Al-Risala al-Abudiyya. The Abudi Risala. He also has a work on Bahth al-Munazara by the same name. See, Dr. Asim, he asks, we need a qasida from you. Is there a reason that aesthetics is not included in the sixfold division of philosophy? Did Aristotle consider it a part of philosophy or merely arts? I thought it was in his organum. We'll need a maybe Sidi Sachi can enlighten us on that. He's our resident Aristotle expert. Maybe some of the others, if somebody, one of the experts in the audience who would like to answer that question or have any knowledge of that, please raise your hand. I can pass you the mic. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not, I only have a cursory knowledge of Aristotle. No volunteers. They're all sleeping. Where does Al-Bidayah fi Usul al-Din, the work translated by Sheikh Faraz Khan, published in the past year, sit as a text in the traditional curriculum in relation to Mawaqif? It's the predecessor of Sharh al-Aqa'id. So you read it before Sharh al-Aqa'id. So it's a Sharh al-Aqa'id and the Safiyyah is a difficult book to read. So that goes just before that. It's like an abridgment of that. And Mawaqif would be after Sharh al-Aqa'id. Given that you start with the text and then reverse engineer the rational arguments, isn't there a risk of confirmation bias? Yeah, but if you look at the logical arguments, you can see that they're true. So that's the benefit of revelation. So there would only be a risk of confirmation bias if the scholars weren't thoroughgoing in their rational arguments, but they were very thoroughgoing. It's like you see one argument, you see it's true here, you see it's true here, you see it's true here, you see it 100 times, then you just say, of course, it's all true. And if you were to look at it, it still turns out to be true. So even if there was a risk, then if it was actual, you would have to look at the rational argument. So as long as they lay out the rational arguments, you can see. Is the intersection of kalam and philosophy the same for Sunnis and Shias? So these books, Sharh al-Mawaqif and Sharh al-Maqasid, and Taftazani and Jurjani and Al-Iji, they are common to the Sunnis and the Shi'is. And the Shi'i tradition, the Shi'i late Kalam tradition, it took from them. But then and there was other, so in At-Tusi is an important Shi'i figure who is commented on by the Sunnis as well. So I think that's a healthy situation. Why? Because it, as long as you're open to rational argument and you expose all of your conclusions to rational inquiry and you commit yourself to going wherever the truth lies, then it's good for everybody, and it gets rid of sectarianism and it takes you to the right conclusion. But it requires discipline to be committed to that. So you have to look at things as somebody who will go wherever the evidence takes you, even if it's outside of your Sunni or Shia school. And that's definitely the kind of approach that reading Sharh al-Mawaqif or Sharh al-Maqasid engenders. That's the benefit of Kalam. So if everybody used their minds and was nice to each other and committed themselves to rational inquiry and coming to the right conclusion and following it regardless of what their parents or their grandparents or their ancestors did or their community does, the world would be a happy place. This is a question for later, probably, but the updating of 3 and 4 in light with modern understandings of the universe is critical, as you've noted. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Totally agreed. Does Ichi believe in immaterial and or eternal entities other than God? Ibn Sina and Ghazali accepted immaterial souls, for example. I'm not sure about Al-Iji himself, but the late Kalam tradition, most of the Mutakallimun, they did not, they were physicalists in the sense that they believed that everything that is contingent is material and it has a location, even the human soul. And they, according to some interpretation, the human soul has a shape of the human body, and there's hadith that kind of indicate that as well. Imam al-Ghazali and others, they held that the human soul is immaterial. So whether something is material or immaterial for the mutakallimun is immaterial, meaning it's not important. So whether or not immaterial objects exist is a purely philosophical question that doesn't have any bearing on your religious belief, as long as you hold that they are contingent. There might be an overlap, actually, if you say that there are certain hadith that indicate that the human soul has a location. But that's the playing field of it. So immaterial objects are, their existence is difficult to prove. The distinction between context of discovery, Dr. Nazif, and the context of justification may help clarify the meaning and role of the phrase ala qanun al-Islam. Revelation inspires and guides us construct rational arguments for the existence of God, which are judged by their rational power. Yeah, I like that. So revelation inspires and guides us to construct rational arguments for the existence of God. And then you judge them by the rational power. Yeah. Jazakumullahu khairan. Is there a translation of Mawaqif in the works? I think it's going to be a work of several lifetimes if somebody does that. It's an incredibly difficult thing to, but maybe we'll do it over a sip of tea. mm. regarding the regarding the cosmological argument for the existence of God, are the late mutakallimun using the concept of preponderance and argue the existence of God as murajjih or mukhassis, a preponderating principle, instead of the classical cosmological argument? Maybe let's take that, let's delay that to the mawqif where we talk about the ilahiyat. And I think that will be a better place to look at that, where we actually delve into the argument in detail. The Sidi Ahmed says, is there a class for the mawaqif, or is the subject a series of webinars? Is this the first off? Not sure. Nothing planned at the moment. I guess the plan right now is just to have an overview of it for people who have, first people to get just general overview, and for others who have some familiarity with how Kalam works to kind of get up to speed quickly and start using it. I guess we'll see what happens after that. What's the significance of Mawaqif in relation to Tusi's Tajreed that preceded it and Taftazani's Maqasid that followed it? I don't know the answer to that question. But I know that they're all, I guess what you mean by, I'm not sure what you mean by significance. If you mean by, well, how is it distinguished, generally be an organization. And with Tulsi, there would be some masail as well. Not sure beyond that. When you add the qualification ala qanun Islam, are you quoting a certain text? Which one? We will do this in the next section. It's common. This is common knowledge. I mean, you'll find it everywhere. And it's there in the Hawashi of Shahr al-Aqa'id. I think it was maybe there on the next page of Kastali. You'll find it in the introduction of, I like this book. I like Kashaf Istilahat al-Funun wal-Ulum al-Islamiyya by Tahanimi. He has the introduction, nice introduction on it. He mentions it there. I'm sure you'll find it in Sharh al-Mawaqib. It's common knowledge. It's not something that you need to dig out from somewhere. Everybody, like, they all say it. Do we need rigorous logic, like Shamsiyah's level, to understand al-Mawaqif and its main shuruh and hawashi? No, you don't need Shamsiyah. Maybe Tahzib. You need modal logic. You need to get to modal logic. You need to do the muwajjahat. Muwajjahat. So you need a text that teaches you that, which is more than the introductory texts. But you don't have to do like the highest level mantak text. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. With respect to the path you trace from Ibn Sina to later Kalam, do you see any influences from the Ishraqi philosophy or others on later Kalam? So I'm not a this would I don't think there are, and but others would be, others in the audience might be more, I would say no, but if there's anyone in the audience who has something to add, then I would be happy to hear. He doesn't figure prominently, in the Mutakallimin don't really have anything to say about him. Is there a response to the objection that the late Kalam cosmological argument commits the fallacy of composition? Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Yes, there is. They deal with it explicitly. Let's do it when we come to the ilahiyat section. I'll tell you, inshallah. I don't have it at my fingertips, but it's explicitly dealt with. It's not very difficult. I mean, what's the fallacy of composition? It's that the basically it says that things as a whole, you can't apply the individual characteristics of the composite to the whole. So you want to say that, yes, the individual things are contingent, but together they're not contingent. Or individually they began to exist, collectively they didn't begin to exist. It's obviously false, but they talk about it. They do. Aren't necessary and contingent among terms that Avicenna introduces in the history of Islam? Yes, but the introduction of a term doesn't mean that the concept wasn't there. So if you go to the science of hadith, the term sahih, the term da'if, the term mawdu' are all terms that were introduced later on. If you go to the science of tafsir, the term sabab al-nuzul, the term is introduced later. If you go to the science of usul, the term am, the term khas, the term muqayyad, the term mutlaq, the term qiyas are all invented later. They weren't there in the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. If you go to all of the sciences, all of the terms are invented at a later period. And the invention of the term, the scholars say, la mushahata fil istilah. There's no arguing over istilah. If somebody introduces a term, that doesn't mean anything. You have to be able to analyze the concept and see if the concept is useful or valid or not. And when we use the concept, we see the concept in the Quran, even though the term isn't there. What are the primary glosses on the Mawaqif? The most important commentary is the commentary of Al-Jurjani, Sharif Al-Jurjani. And then you have Hawashi on that. See, Al-Koti is an important one. There's others. What is the best way to prepare for these sessions? If you, I guess, just read ahead, read the Mawaqif, read the table of contents, look at the discussions, underline sessions, sections that you don't understand, come with your questions. I think they're meant for all of us to kind of learn together. Assalamu alaikum, wa alaikum salam. I'm not sure how Qanun Islam helps here. Wouldn't the Islamic philosophers assert that their conclusions are Islamic, stating that the revelation needs to be interpreted to reflect such conclusions? You're not making an argument. When you say ala qanun Islam, you're not making an argument. So, but you're just describing a reality. So what and that's why what they say ala qanun Islam, the Hawashi, they mention that qanun Islam excludes the positions of the Islamiyun that are clearly un-Islamic, they go against ijma, and they're clearly incorrect. So, but then in order to get to that, you need some kind of a rational argument. So there's a little bit of circularity there, but let's say that for example, his conclusions, he has a particular understanding of what al-qanun Islam is. He put that there, and then that defined his book. And then when he later went back and he looked at the rational arguments, he found that they all lead to ala qanun Islam. So there's a synthesis, there's a rational synthesis that happens. So as long as that rational synthesis happens at the end, then you're okay. If it doesn't, then you're not okay. So if you were to use, the philosopha, if they were to do this, then they would say ala qanun Islam and they put their things there. But when you use when you follow the path of rational inquiry, there would be an inconsistency, there would be an incoherence, which is what Ghazali brought out. So the correctness of it is there when you see that there's no incoherence. And the late scholars of Kalam would say that there's no incoherence in something like the Mawaqif, in the mature Kalam tradition. Dr. Shuaib, you mentioned that some things need to be updated. What would you put on that list? Can you give examples of things that need to be abandoned and what needs to be revised in your opinion? So this is, I kind of refrained from saying too many things there because we have a healthy discussion in ACIPT on what should be and what needs to be there and what doesn't need to be there. And we have disagreements. So I'm in a, I'm more, so what would I do? And this is Hamza speaking. I think that chapter 1 is great. Chapter 2 is really good. And the endings, the last ilahiyat and sam'iyat are there, but everything else needs to be, like, basically the natural philosophy needs to be completely redone. And it's not something that is very difficult to do. And I think that the way to do it is just to take modern science as it is and apply principles of contingency and some of the other concepts that I mentioned in Umma to it. And the result will just look like atoms and molecules. And I'm of the opinion that Kalam atomism is irrelevant in our times. It's outdated. Hylomorphism, I don't think it's needed. I know there's some people in the audience that are jumping out of their seats in shock. But that's what I believe. So I'm not but I feel that that learning the mawaqif is useful because you learn how very intelligent Muslims have spoken to very intelligent philosopher. And in that exchange, there are many lessons that apply, like meta principles that apply to what needs to happen today. But it's highly so I don't so I don't I I'm I think that the section in 3 and 4, they don't need to just be updated. I think it needs to be kind of cast away and like rewritten, and then everything else kind of put into place. But others disagree. Others would be more less inclined, they'd be more conservative. There's another approach, which is to take what's there and try to make modern science fit into this paradigm. I don't agree with that approach. But I mean, we need to, this is a discussion that needs to happen. Could you comment on Ibn Khaldun's criticism of late post-classical kalam? I don't know what it is. If you tell me what it is, then I'll comment. I'm curious, Jazakallah khair for the summary, Yaakum. I'm curious, how do contemporary Jewish and Christian philosophers navigate their philosophical theology if they are in some ways cut off from accurate revelation? No religion can prove it's true except Islam. All other religions, they make claims without proof, they're based on faith, or they make claims that are contradictory, and they commit themselves to those claims, and then they fall into confusion. And that's what I would but this would need to be proven. But as a mutakallim who's kind of looked at the arguments and seen contemporary Christian applications to various contemporary arguments, that's what I'm convinced of. The details of this you would have to ask a Jewish or Christian theologian. Jazakallah khair, you mentioned that the mutakallimun did not engage in the teleological argument as much as Burhan al-Huduth. Why is that? Because the teleological argument doesn't prove the existence of a necessary being. The teleological argument proves the existence of somebody who has knowledge, but it doesn't prove that knowledge, that the one who has that knowledge has it necessarily. That's why a new atheist would say, who designed the designer? That's a common, and that's a valid objection. Because if the universe needs a designer, then who designed the designer? The designer only does not need to be designed if he exists necessarily. So the teleological argument proves the existence of someone with knowledge. It doesn't prove that being exists necessarily. So, and in the Imam al-Ash'ari and in the Quran even, it's the design argument riding on the back of contingency. It's not divorced from contingency. So design after contingency shows knowledge of the creator. Without contingency, it shows knowledge of something, and it's not evidence that thing itself doesn't need anything else to make it exist. Was the term hikmah different to falsafa in post-classical period, or were they synonymous? They were synonymous. David, mashallah, ahlan wa sahlan. Will there be emphasis on distinguishing questions that are purely philosophical from those that actually count as doctrine, and the criteria for determining this? I think the idea is that there'll be a variety of different presenters, and so I think they'll bring their perspectives. If something that I present, I will do that, inshallah. You have to, I'll save that as for a future. Do the post Ibn Sina Kalam thinkers basically equate Qadim with Wujub? No, they're different. And Imkan with Hudooth? No, they're different. So there, one leads to the other, but they're different. The hadith, if you say the universe is hadith, the conclusion is the existence of a sani', a maker, who is qadim. If you say the universe is mumkin, the conclusion is the existence of someone who's wajib. So you have arguments that are for isbatul wajib, and you have arguments that are for isbatul qadim, or isbatul sani'. So they're different. They do distinguish. Are there any mutakallimun who hold that creation is necessary for God? None of the Ash'aris or Maturidis would hold that. That's the position of the philosopher who say, if you say it's necessary, you negate divine will and divine agency. So this was one of the things that Ghazali, that Taftazani mentioned, that the mutakallimun corrected in what they went against the revelation. In contemporary discussions, should we, not sure how long to go for, it's like the, in contemporary discussions, should we use Dalil al-Huduth, using the accidents of movement to prove that the world began to exist, or should we just stick to the argument from contingency? The Dalil al-Huduth, it's a good question. So Dalil al-Huduth, in the works of the Mutakallimun, they use accidents and of movements and stillness or some other accidents to prove that the world began to exist. So this is Dalil al-Huduth in the vocabulary of the natural philosophy that we studied. So, and this is what you'll find in the Sanusiya, you'll find in the Jawhara. It'll talk about A'rad, it will talk about Jawahir, and then it's going to construct an argument. So all of that, it's ineffective because nobody thinks about the universe in that way anymore. So you have to express it in a different vocabulary, and so you would express it in the language of temporal events, for example, a series of temporal events. This is something that people now understand. But the whole Arad Johar distinction, it's not something that people understand anymore, because they don't think of the world in that way. I've seen the argument from contingent beings to the necessary God in its articulation in Avicenna. How could we then ascribe it to the Mutakallimun? Are there any Mutakallim who talked about it before Avicenna? It's in the Quran, right? So what the Mutakallim, so Avicenna was a Muslim. So Avicenna was a Muslim, and his Islamic beliefs influenced the work that he did. And then the Mutakallimun, they took the things that he did that were good, and then they took them, and then they improved on them, and they corrected them. So the approach of the Mutakallimun is the famous saying, Al-Hikmatu Dallatul Mu'min. Wisdom is the lost camel of the believer, or the lost property of a believer. And meaning, if you find something that's correct, you take it from whoever it is. So if it wasn't Avicenna, if it was Aristotle, you would take it. if it was anyone, you would take it. So the thing is it correct? Is it not correct? It's correct. But did he invent it? He didn't invent it. Before him, it's there in the Quran. And in my estimation, the best book of Kalam is the Tafsir of Fakhruddin al-Razi. And when you read that, you see how everything that the Mutakallimun say is there, right there in the Quran. And so you don't see that in Sharh al-Mawaqif, but you'll see that in al-Razi. So so he was describing something that is Quranic. And I gave a talk yesterday with Dr. Shoaib on the contingency argument, where it's up on YouTube, Academic Access, where I tried to describe that there. So inshallah, if you can have a look at that, and if you have any follow-up questions, I'd love to engage with you. You can email me at hamza@basireducation.org. Did Ghazali's notion of mushahada informing aql and nas rooted in his munqidh play any role in the later development of kalam? I think Imam Ghazali's munqidh min al-dalal is misinterpreted. It's misinterpreted as a criticism of kalam. I don't think that's what he intended. Imam al-Ghazali would approve of everything that's in the Mawaqif, but he would say that there's something more. There's a higher mode of knowing. And that's mushahada, which is direct experiential knowledge. And that gives you something that rational arguments don't give you. But rational arguments are important. So that's how I would interpret it. And I think that fits better with what he uses rational arguments in the Ihya, he uses it in the Mustasfa, he uses it in Qawaid al-I'tiqad, in Al-Iqtisad for the I'tiqad. So there's something more than kalam, definitely. But that doesn't negate kalam. What other instrumental sciences besides logic are important prerequisites for a late kalam text like the Mawaqif? I think that's all you need. However, in order to understand kalam in its proper place, you need to have studied some tafsir, you have to have studied some hadith, you need to study some fiqh, you need to study some usul. Otherwise, what happens is when you study kalam, you end up doing falsafa. But if you see kalam at work in the other Islamic sciences, then it ends up being placed in its context. So, If you read the Madrasa curriculum in context work that I pointed you to, you'll see how it interplays with everything else. And that's how it needs to, in order to have a good judgment, you need to have this other training in the other sciences as well. Tajdeed kalam should not be committed to a specific physical ontology such as atomism. No. So I guess I would say it differently. I would say that the contingency of the universe is compatible with a hylomorphic and an atomistic world. And the Mutakallimun said that. And so somebody, one of the, there's a quote from Maulana Ashraf Ali Thanvi. It's everywhere. It's like, it's well known. It's well known in the longer works. So atomism is not aqidah. It's falsafa. And it's different kind of atomism. It's not like modern atomism. It's modern atomism, scientific atomism is completely different. So to equate the two is also a big mistake. Are you inclined to rewrite sections 3 and 4 yourself, or do you know of others working on this? I don't know of anybody who's working on this. And I'm not qualified to rewrite it. If I was, then I wouldn't be over here. What level of usul is required before studying maqasid? You need to know how it relates to usul. So something like the talwih should be done parallel to maqasid, like the talwih or the book of Baydawi or something that fits kalam into usul. in terms of logical possibilities, wouldn't one of the two necessarily be true, atomism or hylomorphism? Can there logically be a third possibility? I don't know. Not sure. I saw in the history of philosophy that by using the contingent term, Avicenna has been able to solve a philosophical problem that is seen in Aristotle, i.e. the notorious claim that everything that is eternal is necessary. According to Avicenna, then, something can be eternal, but again contingent. This is somehow against what you said, that contingent equates hadith. Is what you said the belief of the Mutakallimun? Yes. So the Mutakallimun would disagree with Avicenna on this. This is a famous point of disagreement between the Mutakallimun and Avicenna. So the Mutakallimun believe that contingent is not equal to hadith, but one entails the other. So if something is hadith, it's contingent. That's easy to see because it exists and does not exist. Therefore, it's contingent. It can exist and it cannot exist. And from contingency to hudooth, it's that if something was qadim, it would not need anything. It's no longer dependent. So, and there's other arguments too. But this is a famous point of distinction, disagreement between Avicenna and the Mutakallimun. Ala qanun al-shara brings up the question of qanun al-ta'wil, particularly how cosmological verses are to be interpreted. Yeah. It's like the opposite. It's like ala qanun al-shara in reverse. So people have begun leaving. So let me... everybody is free to leave. So no compulsion to stay. I'll stay until as long as somebody has questions. To expand on my question, Sidi Khalil, that Kalam thinkers would say only the wajib al-wujud is qadim, and likewise for every mumkin al-wujud is muhdas. Is that the case? Yes. Dr. Nazif, Brother Hamza, do you think that we may need extra argument than the contingency argument to ground the ontological distinction between the necessary being and contingent beings, i.e. the transcendence of God? Because someone may propose a scenario like the one advocated by Spinoza's monism, to which necessary being is not transcendent and contingent beings are modes. How would we block this scenario? If it's not transcendent, then it's contingent. If it's not transcendent, then it resembles contingent things. And anything that resembles contingent things is contingent. I want to get in touch with you, Sidi Nazif, Brother Nazif. I will, I think I have your email. So I'll try and send you an email, but I want to get in touch with you, inshallah. I'll send you a message. Are there differences between Ash'aris, Maturidis, and Asaris in how they understand objective morality? For example, Urethra's dilemma. How would each school give the same response to it or a different response? So I think this is it'll come in Ilahiyat. So we can look in the Ilahiyat section there, inshallah. You propose to take modern sciences finding that they're given, but don't they keep changing all the time? Yeah, I might be mistaken, right? So don't take anything that I say. You should take everything I say with a grain of salt. So I will. I think there's things that could be said, but it's good, to think critically about what I say. That's the spirit of Kalam. So it's good, mashallah. Would you recommend studying a primer to philosophy, like Abhari's Hidayah and Dialectics, before studying the Mawaqif and its Sharh, mainly for terminology? Yes, good. So this is, somebody said, is logic enough? But something like this would probably be needed as well. You would need some little bit of falsafa, and you would need some dialectics to understand the back and forth. Who are the muhaqqiqoon of the Maturidi school, and what are their works? The Ash'aris and Maturidi schools merge in Sharh al-Mawaqif and Sharh al-Maqasid. So at this level, you're no longer an Ash'ari, you're no longer a Maturidi. You're just doing everything. You're just looking at the rational conclusions. So the schools exist in the early works. In the late works, everything merges. Are the laws of mathematics wajib? If so, are they qadim? There is an intrinsic wajib, and there's a wajib bishart something. So they're not intrinsically wajib. So it returns to identity, right? So the laws of mathematics returns to statements of identity, and for a thing to be what it is wajib, but it's not the same as saying that for something to exist is wajib. They're two different kinds of wujub. So the wujub that exists as a statement of identity within created things these are tautologies. This is an approximate statement. There's a section in the books of logic where they talk about this. I'll have to dig it up, but that's the upshot of it. $1 million question. The ultimate kalam question of today. This is a joke. Could kalam allow you to believe in evolution? If yes, do you? I need to see the $1 million first. I'll answer your question. So this is author of Islam and Evolution. Speaking. Assalamu alaikum, wa alaikum salam. Is infinite regress of creation possible for God to create? We're getting into specific theological questions here. So I think that we'll have to, a lot of these things, they require Prophet Muhammad's Nubuwwah, may Allah be pleased with him, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So these specifics, I think they're beyond the scope of today's session. Maybe we can defer them to some other session, inshallah. Is Mu'in al-Falsafa an adequate introduction to falsafa? I haven't read it. Jazakumullahu khairan to everybody. Thank you everybody for joining. Inshallah the recording, there'll be an edited version of this recording, inshallah it'll go up on YouTube. I'll send out an announcement. So I'm looking forward to seeing you in the next session, and it'll be announced soon, inshallah. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.